What the fuck do I need you for? I got my phone, motherfucker.
The project itself has been, you know, an absolute joy, but you know, the creation and you know, putting it together and then the problems that I've come up against you know, makes you know, Putin looks like a, you know, an angel kind of, you know, in a lot of it. I just kind of I still don't get it, you know, why some of these issues, you know, a lot of these issues are happening. Yeah. I kind of, well, I say I don't get it. I see what's happening, and I kind of understand what's happening, but that doesn't mean that it's you know, whatever. Anyway, so, you know, I have plenty to say. You know, it depends where you ask me and where we end up going with this. So.
Yeah, but that's why I think this sort of conversation is important, though, because we keep bringing new kids into the industry saying all you need to do is ABC and then, you know, it's all going to work out. And it's really interesting to meet someone like yourself who is producing such beautiful music. And by the way, I just opened one of the tracks you sent me just then.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot to do that. So just we transferred you a couple of them.
Yeah, and it was what was the one I listened to straight away? It was absolutely fantastic. The reason was the one I clicked on.
Reason, yeah.
And
yeah,
man, I love that song already. So but to see that and to see the great musicians you've had involved, and you know, I really want to know about the story and how it all came to be. But you would think that with all of those boxes ticked, you know, you'd be away. And then I saw your email earlier, I mean your Facebook post earlier this year, and I thought, there you go, there's a wake-up call, you know. So I thought we need to talk about this.
Yeah, well, you know, it was, you know, I mean the thing's been, you know, 12-13 years, you know, in the making, and then having then just, you know, well, again, we can talk about this during the session, but I mean, the reality was that when I set out, I mean, I had been asked by so many people, because I'd been writing for 20 years and just, you know, doing stuff, but, you know, never doing anything with it. And then people and friends just kept saying, you know, are you ever going to do anything with this damn stuff? I mean, I had something like 300-400 songs.
Right.
And I just said, well, look, you know, I would consider recording a number of the tracks. I said, but I don't want to, if I'm going to do it, my only aim is for it to be kind of at the end of it, if it's worthy of being played in my car, then, you know, because not much makes it into my car with my old CD player in my car.
Right.
You know, but if it's worthy of that, then it's kind of job done.
Yeah.
And then whatever happens to it, to be honest, after that, you know, as I was, I don't really care after that. I kind of, you know, I've done the thing.
Right.
So that was the original ambition. Mm. And I had, you know, zero knowledge of how, you know, recording worked. I had zero knowledge of how, you know, producing or arranging. I had, you know, zero technology ability. And again, I had zero idea of how the music industry worked. And so a lot of it was like, you know, it wasn't so much made assumptions, but I kind of thought, okay, well, you know, let's try this route. And then, you know, that's when I started to bring in one or two people to sort of say, so then, well, listen, you know, I've seen what you've done there. Could you help me with this? And that's how it kind of, you know, whatever else. But then each sort of wave, you know, I mean, for example, to get through to the first kind of level of acceptance took me 2.5 years, probably 40 recording sessions and about 30, 40 session musicians to get to the point where I thought, right, I might have something.
Mm, yeah.
But a lot of it was kind of like, well, hang on, how come I'm not getting this? It seems to be relatively simple and whatever, and you know, immediately coming up against, you know, constraints and issues from that point forward. So that's what, you know, so just to get the first line of first, you know, a first line of a track recorded and acceptable was a 2.5 year 40 session process to get to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, then I wouldn't say it became easier, but then it became more understandable.
Mm.
But that's how, even from that point, you know, that starting point was kind of, there seemed to be an awful lot of barriers to what I would assume would be quite logic and straightforward.
Yes, yes.
And so, well, actually, this is the way that it's done. And I'm just saying, well, it's not quite, I'm not doing anything based on history or whatever else. I'm just trying to capture a song in a particular way.
Mm.
And you're telling me the only way to do that is this way. Well, this way clearly isn't working. So how about, you know, and then it would be. Yeah, so anyway, that's
how it is. So what is your background then, just before we jump fully into that story? You know, are you did you come up performing live, or, you know, what's your background with music?
I was classically trained on the piano and cello.
Mm-hmm.
I learned the piano and cello from about the age of 7 or 8. And I ended up actually going to there's a music school up in Manchester in the north of England called Chetham's School of Music, which is, you know, it's probably one of the most renowned music schools in England. And I ended up going there primarily to study the cello.
Mm-hmm.
And so my musical interest kind of really started there, albeit I was studying classical. I'd already got and formed an interest in but not a great understanding, but an interest in sort of, you know, my pivotal bands were the likes of Supertramp and Steely Dan.
They were
like my, you know, I would listen to the stuff and just think, how are they doing this? What is this amazing? What's this weird magic? It's kind of like, you know, what, and to this day with Steely Dan, I still have that sort of thing. It's just like, I don't know what the hell they're doing, but it sounds amazing.
Exactly.
And I can't figure it out, but I've listened to this 40 times and I still don't know what the hell they're doing. So it was, and what happened was I studied the cello and I got to the age of 16, and I was told by my my cello tutor, listen, you're now essentially at concert cellist standard. If you want to go on and have a career with a cello, then it's kind of 10 hours a day for the next 30 years, and you will be performing on the big stages doing all the big cello concertos. And I just thought, holy shit, I don't want to be doing that. So I literally gave up. It's just like, that wasn't my, I didn't have an ambition. It was something that I found, you know, I really enjoyed the process. Mm. and the learning and everything else. And
because a lot of people would have been like stoked to hear that, like, really great. That sounds like a fantastic life. You're like, nah.
Yeah, but I think I was already, and even by the age of 16, I was kind of already, you know, and this has been a lot, you know, big learning curve. I was already under the kind of cloud of some kind of childhood issues, mm-hmm. you know, personal issues that were already beginning to kind of show themselves, albeit I had no understanding or clue at the time as to why that was happening. Mm. I got into a very, from about the age of, you know, 12, 13, I got into a very kind of self-destructive pattern on anything. So whether it was just learning something and then like not seeing it through or whatever it may be, there was almost, it wasn't a fear of success, but it was like success seemed to be too, failure or living with the pain of failure seemed to be a place I kind of understood,
right?
Or felt more at home with. I didn't feel comfortable with it. And whereas when there were these signs of, you know, I mean, like for example, I was, you know, at the age of 14, I ended up performing the Elgar Cello Concerto with the Halle Orchestra in Manchester in front of 2,000 people.
Wow!
And when I came off, I was physically sick. I couldn't speak for about 3 or 4 hours and whatever else. And already from then I was, and then when I used to do like some string quartets and stuff. And so whenever I performed afterwards, I couldn't function. I could hardly breathe. I could hardly whatever. And that was, and so seeing that through to the next level, even at that point, just felt, I thought, well, if I'm going to feel like that when I'm doing this now, what the hell am I going to feel like as it
ramps up. Yeah.
So that was the thing. So, you know, again, so I gave up the cello instantly. And for my last year at that music school, I took up the jazz double bass, much to the horror of my music teachers and everybody else. And family and God knows what else.
I can relate to what you're saying about that, because that's a version of more or less just lack of self-confidence, isn't it? Lack of self-belief. And you end up becoming, a lot of people do this, I think they end up subtly having a level of self-sabotage that they don't even, they're not even aware of.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, in fact, only recently I've been kind of discussing the notion of self-harm, you know, not necessarily just physical, but, you know, mentally and spiritually and everything else.
Yes.
And when I've looked back, it seemed to be a lot of version of that. And I don't think it was necessarily down to a lack of confidence because I knew I could do it. I mean, I remember again when I, about 13, 14, there was, at the time there was a world famous concert cellist called Paul Tertelier. Mm-hmm. And he actually, he ran a conservatoire in Paris and he invited me to go over there and study there. And I said no, because I was already feeling, it's not because I didn't feel, you know, when a piece of music like the Bach cello suites or something was put in front of me, or the Dvorak cello concerto, I'd kind of, you know, given a few tries and gone or else, I'd kind of nail it quite quickly and do my own thing, and actually got to the point where on a lot of occasions, my teacher was just saying, you know, what have you just played? And I said, well, I've played What's in Rhyme. I said, no, you've actually put in notes that don't exist. You know, be creative and put your own characteristic on it. And I mean, that's where a lot of the frustrations with classical music started. I just thought, well, yeah, fine. How many ways can you interpret something that's a fixed black and white?
Yes.
Dots in front of you?
Yes.
And you know, I'd heard lots of people, you know, interpret all of those amazing concertos and stuff in astonishing ways, but it was like I kind of thought, well, actually this sounds good, and I put in a nose or a phrase that didn't exist and God knows what else, you know, and I think from that point I was kind of doomed, it wasn't a lack of confidence or even belief in myself. It was more a question of, you know, doing it well and receiving an accolade or whatever else, that's the bit that didn't feel comfortable in the slightest.
Yeah.
That was the bit I had real trouble with.
I had a similar kind of conflict when I was a teenager. I was often on stage in front of hundreds, sometimes thousands of people for various things, and I was often doing very well. And I had this, what appeared to be confidence. I think I was confident, you know, and I had this determination and the sense of this has got to happen, this is what I'm here for or whatever. But I also, underneath that, I had insecurities and imposter syndrome and all of those things playing out as well, thanks to some awful people in my childhood, you know, and
sure.
And I've never really quite made sense of what was going on. How can I have been so self-deprecating in my internal dialogue and yet walk out on stage at 15 in front of 2,000 people and dominate the room? You know what I mean? Like, it makes less sense the older I get and the further away I get from it.
Exactly. And you know, I'm older than you, and I know it's, I've struggled with that, you know, up until now, and still struggling with that because, you know, it actually is dead. It kind of less, it makes, you know, I've kind of been on a search for answers. You know, I always sort of thought, well, there's got to be a reason. And when I kind of finally got to understand a bit about that reason, it actually made it harder.
Right.
It was like it didn't think, oh, okay, well, because of that, that's why I've behaved like this for you know, the last 40 years or whatever else. It actually made it harder. You know, and it kind of contradicted. You know, I mean, you know, I went to see masses of counselors and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, there were various supposed breakthroughs. But actually what happened as a result of those breakthroughs is that I had a moment in time, whether it be a day or a week, where I suddenly felt completely unencumbered from a lot of the, you know, anxieties that I'd felt. And then suddenly all those things would slam back in.
Right.
Not triggered by anything necessarily, and they would feel 10 times worse than they did last time.
Isn't that part of the challenge of getting older And I don't mean any particular age, but the older you get, the more self-aware you become about the fact that there are people out there who are exceptional at what they do, and you sort of get a better idea of where you are in the world and how you compare to people and that kind of stuff. It's almost like when you're younger, the level of ignorance that comes with being younger is in some ways quite freeing. You're not as worried about everything because you don't know anything. You know what I mean? And then you grow up and get more self-aware, more aware of what's going on. You think, fuck, I don't stack up to anything, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it was always, you know, I kind of, funny enough, you know, so after music school and doing my double bass, I kind of didn't really, well, I pursued music a bit. And again, what happened, I went out and auditioned for various bands and I got offered a lot of stuff and some tours and session work. And I, you know, every single time I went out actively looking for it. Once I was offered it, I would then walk away from it.
Interesting.
I mean, I did some of them. You know, I worked with, you know, a good number of, you know, people sort of early on. And I just thought, well, I mean, you know, a part of it was, do I really want to be sitting here playing somebody else's stuff? But I didn't have any ambition to do anything with my own material, even at that age. It was kind of like, you know, I mean, I couldn't sing for shit. In terms of playing the piano, I could sit down and write a tune,
right,
and whatever else, and I would, but you know, I wasn't, you know, technically on the piano, it was very, very basic. Cello had been my main instrument. It's not easy to write songs on a cello. So there was always that element of, well, I'm never going to be a performer. I don't want to become, I mean, I, for example, again, very early on, I was offered a writing deal with what was Warner Chappell, you know, a long, 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 long time ago. But again, and then, you know, when that started, it was just like, well, what we need you to do is write this 3.5 minute thing for so-and-so and whatever. It's just like, nah, this is not how I feel and see about it.
Yeah.
So at the point of potential success, whether it be within music or anything else, I would just like, no, this doesn't feel right and comfortable. And then there would be, as you said earlier, there'd be this constant self-destructing, you know, button going off.
Yeah.
Because it felt easier to kind of remain anxious. It felt safer, albeit it was a nasty place to be.
Yeah. So did you end up landing in a different career that you stayed in for a while?
So yeah, I ended up, God knows what. I mean, I ended up doing, I remember I was doing pyramid selling of water filters. I ended up doing selling electric organs in Oxford Street in the center of London at one of the department stores.
Yep.
I ended up then going into, became a real estate agent. Hideous.
I've got friends who have done that and they said it's absolutely terrible.
You know, what? Because again, the idea of sales and stuff, just whatever else. And I wasn't, and I ended up actually then, you know, having got some experience, I ended up starting up my own businesses doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then I kind of almost, you know, and I built those businesses up. And again, I ended up almost sort of self-destructing those businesses because I just like, you know, of just, you know, I hated the language of business and I hated the you know, what was necessary to go with that side of things. So I've kind of, you know, and I've floated around lots of other different areas. I ended up, I was always kind of interested in, for example, I'd just become fascinated by old historical maps, for example.
Yeah.
And so I suddenly started just collecting them and I ended up actually kind of building up a business, buying and selling old, you know, maps. And, you know, I'd fly to one part of the world, buy a load of these old maps and then take them to another part of the world and sell them out there and whatever else. And
wow. How did you figure out there was a market for that?
Well, it was just, you know, again, well, I figured, you know, when I got interested in them, I thought, well, I'd like to, you know, I just started to learn about them and whatever and realize. And then, you know, I discovered there was a very big collecting fraternity, you know, you know, tens of thousands of people doing these things. So I kind of thought, well, so I just, but I kind of got to the point where I'd kind of accumulated so many of them that I needed to kind of, in one way, I thought, well, actually, I better sell one or two of these things to help buy the next one. So, you know, the more that I learned, that I want to go and get this one now, but I didn't actually have the money. So I ended up starting to sell, you know, some of the things. And that, it just got to the point where that was making more money than my real job, you know, at the time or whatever else.
Right.
So it's just like, well, I'll go off and do this.
Yeah.
And whatever. And you know, again, just, you know, and I still kind of, you know, even now dabble in that a bit and here and there. But I mean, it's
that sounds like a great side gig for you. If that's something that you're, you know, really passionate about and it's working for you, why not?
Well, yeah, but it was almost like a self deflection kind of thing. I enjoyed it and I kind of understood it, but I didn't understand the aspects of trying to run a proper business with it. I would just kind of fly by the seat of my pants and then make a lot of decisions which didn't have any business logic, but they felt right to me.
Right.
And that in itself would cause conflict and sort of that. But yeah, it's been a you know, but again, I would find myself in whatever I was doing, always ending up kind of moving down a route which would end up in some kind of destruction, you know, self-destruction thing again, because it was, you know, and I think after sort of, you know, that became so habitual that I almost kind of subconsciously went into things almost knowing that an inevitable outcome was going to be some, you know, contention.
It's like starting a relationship with someone without being fully committed because you know it's not going to work anyway. So you're sort of half, one foot in, one foot out sort of deal, right?
Yeah. I suppose that's the point, but I would find myself behaving in such a way that I would end up doing something that was really was untenable to the point where there was almost no return from it, and I would force it. It wasn't a pre-planned trajectory, but I just naturally ended up almost creating conflict in order to give me a way out of the uncomfortable feeling. And again, this has been the same in the music. So it wasn't, again, you know, that went on for, you know, dancing around all these various things for years and years. And I always kind of, I had, you know, my interest in music was still, you know, enormous. And I would probably for the best part of 15 years, I would go to something like 15, 20 years. I used to go to something like 100 gigs a year.
Wow.
Constantly, you know, I'd go and see two or three bands a week.
Yeah.
You know, not just around the UK, but I'd fly off to Europe and I'd fly off to the States sometimes if there was, you know, people playing there that I wanted to see or whatever else. So I had a constant, you know, need for, you know, kind of ingesting music in so many different, you know, and whatever else. And that was always there. And again, at the same time, then I'd come back and I'd write a load of stuff and which most of it was always done on my trusty old, I haven't got it to hear, to hand immediately, a trusty old cassette recorder. And to this day, everything that I've ever written has been done on that. So I just put that on top of the piano, press record and play.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's how, you know, when I first started with this, you know, the very first person I approached to help me, you know, look at how I can move this forward. He's a pretty well known producer, a guy called Matt Butler. I mean, he produced some albums for John Martin and Deacon Blue and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I very first approached him. I mean, he lived quite a long way away, but we arranged to meet, and I was so kind of freaked out about my lack of ability physically on the piano that I took along this bloody cassette player and pressed play and said, "Well, this is what I've written,
right?
You know, whatever. Try and get the message across." So, yeah, I just, you know, I'd always kept an interest. And then it was around sort of late sort of 2008, 2009, that by then, you know, just friends and family and whatever just kind of started saying, Jesus Christ, you've got all this stuff. Mm. Just, you know, are you going to do something? And that, and that's really when it started. So yeah, it's, you know.
And was the original idea to start off with, let's say, a smaller ensemble, you know, to get a quartet and just record an album or something like that? Or did you, as it ended up being with all of the different people involved, is that sort of the vision you had at the start, that it might grow to something like that?
Well, I mean, right at the very beginning, it was just like, okay, well, I've got this stuff. I need to select, you know, 8 or 10 tracks. And I suppose my first thought, all I wanted to do was, well, I know how I want it to sound, but I've got no idea how to make that happen.
Right.
So what I need to do is speak to an experienced producer who's done stuff that I've liked, and just say, right, this is, I've kind of got this in mind, and, you know, I'd love to hear this kind of vibe or this kind of thing and you know, whatever else. And and, you know, and again, you know, then they, you know, just said, well, listen, actually, well, let's go and get, you know, I know this nice little studio. We went to a place, it was a studio called Yellow Shark in Cheltenham, mm-hmm. in the southwest of England. And he sort of then started inviting, you know, he'd got some fairly good contacts and started inviting various people across, and you know, they'd come in and they'd play some stuff, and I'm like, oh, you know, that's kind of interesting, and that's kind of, so really, I didn't have any at that stage. I hadn't formed any plan in terms of, right, I want, you know, this particular band or this particular group of musicians. It was much more about how can I didn't really, you know, I had an awareness of lots of amazing musicians, but it was just more a case of, well, how do we go about trying to make this happen? And in those sort of, you know, but it was, you know, in those kind of first 20, 30, 40 sessions, I got a tiny bit out of each one.
Right.
But what was happening was, it felt like I was kind of making a feature length cartoon. So I'd come out of sort of a day's session with like 3 seconds of something that I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I was told, right, well, the way that you need to do it is, what we'll do, we'll go and record all these sessions with all these people, and you'll then have 15, 20 takes of each bits and pieces. And then what we'll do is, it will stitch, you know, we'll take 5 seconds of that one and we'll stitch it. And I just said, no. What I want is 95% of one.
Yeah.
And fine, I understand the concept of a little bit of cleaning up and whatever else, but what I want to hear is what these amazing musicians can come and do and interpret. You know, I'm asking them to bring their imprimatur of what they've been involved in previously.
Yes, exactly.
And bring it into the room.
I've always been amazed by that in studios where they automatically just cut everything up and quantize and tune everything and stuff. I remember being in one of the biggest studios in New Zealand at one point, and we were mixing a track and the drums hadn't been quantized, but they were a good take. And the engineer said, man, if I had my way, I'd go and quantize the drums. And I said, but the drums are great. They sound great. And he went, yeah, but it's just standard. And I said, so are you saying if you had someone like Steve Jordan, you know, playing, or you know, I named a few other great drummers, you would automatically quantize it? And he goes, yeah, it's just standard. And I thought, why would you, you know, like, then why would
you know? And this is the thing. And I think, you know, a lot of the time, you know, what was happening was that some of these, you know, some really good musicians were coming in. But in fairness to them, the way that they had worked previously or been told to work previously, I mean, they'd been told to sort of work within an inch of their lives. In other words, they would come in for their 3-hour session.
Yeah.
They were given, you know, they were told, play this note for note this way and that way. Give me 8 or 10 takes and we'll then do our thing to it.
Yeah.
And it was just like, well, hang on a second. That's, to me, that was just completely ridiculous. Mm. So a lot of the time, when, you know, I remember there were so many sessions where I'd say to them, right, listen, you know, forget what you've heard. Just play instinctively. Give me something that I'm not telling you I want this note and with this rhythm or whatever else. Play me something, you know, this, you need to create a line that's going to sit underneath this or that or whatever else.
Yeah.
Just do your thing. And it got to the point where I remember on quite a few sessions is that I would get to the point where all I would actually end up leaving them with is the click track. I wouldn't actually give them any guide or anything at all.
Yeah.
And because of their habitual way of how they'd been told to do session work in the past, they literally weren't able, they couldn't comprehend that level of freedom, creative freedom,
right?
Because they'd never been allowed to do that. So given that opportunity, they couldn't quite, you know, let go completely.
Families grow and change so quickly, and so many of us forget how important it is to be in the photo and not just the one taking it. Little and Legend Photography believe you deserve to have those beautiful memories captured by an experienced photographer who understands how important these moments are for you. Let them help you preserve your family story as it is now, so you can cherish it for years to come. Check them out at littleandlegend.co.nz. That's littleandlegend.co.nz. Are you talking about the musicians you started with, you know, initially? Because some of the musicians you ended up with, I don't know the audit sequence of when they all came on board, but some of the musicians you ended up with were so well known for being innovative and creative, you know?
I think what happened was that one of the first sort of musical breakthroughs is that, so this guy Matt Butler had worked with John Martin for many years.
Yeah.
And about, I think, probably sort of musician number 18 or 20 was a guy called Spencer Cousins. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew of Spencer. Spencer had basically played with John Martin for about the last 18, 19 years of John's life. Mm. And I must have seen John Martin, you know, 30 times live or whatever else. And you know, had been very aware of Spencer. And actually, you know, Spencer said, well, listen, Matt said, let me get Spencer in. And when Spencer came in, I said he was kind of like number 19 or 20 or something. It was the first time that I got that inkling of, right, here's someone who's been allowed freedom of expression. Even so, he's been playing for the likes of, you know, and touring with the likes of John Martin and whatever else. Hmm. You know, he, Spencer described how they would do their recording sessions and whatever else, and you know, John's Martin way was a complete kind of free for all. It was kind of, you know, they'd go in and he would welcome, you know, he wouldn't sit there saying do this, do that. He would just, you know, he'd start on some kind of vibe and just the band would join in and they would experiment and end up with something.
Yeah.
And hope that the engineer had caught it, you know, caught that take or whatever else. And that was kind of, you know, when Sven came in and started playing a few things, it's like, okay, now I've found someone who understands this concept of listen, yes, I've written this 4-minute song or this 6-minute song, and it's got a structure, it's got, you know, a vocal line, it's got, you know, a chord sequence, it's got, you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
And it's got a feel and everything else. But I'd always imagine my thing was, right, I'm bringing in you, whoever you are, not to do your own thing, but I'm bringing you in to provide you with a place where you can bring something to the table that I couldn't possibly have imagined.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I want you, it's not that I want you to surprise me. I want you to come up with something that I couldn't have conceived.
Right.
Or I haven't conceived, because I don't want to go into these things with too much, you know, again, pre-concept. You know, I've got an idea of a sound and I've got an idea of a feel, but actually, who am I to, you know, tell, you know, for example, the likes of Pino Palladino,
right,
how to play a part.
Yeah.
You know, he's played on, you know, 600 albums and God knows what else. And it was that. So, and Sven was the first guy that kind of, I think, got it.
Yeah.
He, and so we then sort of ended up having another sort of 15, 20 sessions, bringing in various other, again, very competent, very able, you know, people, and never really. And it was during that time that I realized, okay, actually, I need to go up the musical, you know, food
chain
or whatever else, and find people who have been able to be in environments which have allowed that kind of freedom.
Well, one of my favorite musicians and one of my biggest influences over the years has been Dominic Miller. And he's someone who has worked, you know, in an environment where he has been he's an incredibly disciplined musician, of course, but he's also someone who is very capable at improvising and that kind of fusion-y collaborative approach. So I'm really, you know, I'd love to hear what your experience was working with him.
I'll certainly highlight that and whatever else, because again, I mean, Dominic was effectively then the next link in the chain having spent a lot of time with Spencer and whatever and realizing actually what could be achieved, that's when I kind of started to kind of, I then created my kind of wants list,
right,
of, okay, what I wanted to do was I never wanted to get into anything that had a previous formula or a previous kind of established sound or vibe. It was like, okay, this particular song, I kind of wanted to start from scratch all over again. And I mean, there's a lot of tracks where I've had, Sven has featured on, probably five or six tracks and various other artists, but I've mixed it up, not out of, I mean, at the end of the day, in terms of recorded musicians, I've ended up using about 60 different musicians on the final eight tracks.
Wow.
Just for the sake of it, but it's like, well, actually, what would happen if I put, I've got this thing in my head, this sound, this feel.
Mm.
Who do I think could be a part of this, of working within the song structure that could bring something, take it to another level? And so it was like this kind of, someone just described me as this kind of mad, kind of witch with a big cauldron hurling in these various musicians, whatever, and kind of seeing what comes out.
Mm.
And that was true, because it was like, there was an element of it's pretty well known, Steely Dan's, in this, once they really got going and they used to go through hundreds of session musicians, you'd get the call from Steely Dan saying, hi, can you come and do a session? You'd think, oh my God, I've made it. I'm going to do a Steely Dan session. They'd go along, they'd do one take, and the guys would say, thank you, that's great, that's fantastic. And then the next day they'd have somebody else in.
Right.
And so you'd walk out of the session thinking, my God, I'm going to be on a Steely Dan record. You know, what they didn't know was that there was 14 other drummers and 16 other keyboard players and whatever else. And it was always a question of whoever came in and did that one take, did the thing in a way which sat perfectly, that was fine. They would never get one person to do 10 takes. It was always like getting to do one take. And if they nailed it, fine. And if they didn't, it was like, thank you very much, it's great, there's your $300 and whatever else, and that's it. And it wasn't until the album came out that most of these people realized that they weren't on the bloody album.
Right.
Whatever. And again, it was partly that I thought, well, who could we possibly get? There were many times where I wanted people who had worked with each other previously on various other projects, but I would always then want to throw something into the mix that would not shake it up for the sake of it, but to think, well, wouldn't it be incredible if we got X and Y into the room? They'd know of each other and this kind of stuff, but see what would happen what would the synergy be like?
Yeah.
So a lot of it was about, you know, I ended up writing out this wish list of, you know, 50, 60 musicians that would love to work with. And then sort of thinking, right, okay, well, this is the next track I'm going to do. And then start to sort of work through, right, well, it'd be great. I think he would be fantastic for this. She would be great for that. You know, whatever it was.
Mm.
And then I suppose that's when, you know, the next sort of blockage came up, was then trying to get to these people.
Exactly.
And it was sort of that's when I had to really, you know, after sort of doing 40 sessions and then, yeah, getting a few, you know, a very useful introduction, you know, to Spencer, and then, you know, Dominic Miller ended up being the next one. But I had to go, what I had to do to get to Dominic Miller with some credibility, because who the hell was I, you know, calling up saying, would you come and play on my record, please, Dom?
Yeah.
It was the problems kind of then started all over again, and it became easier again. There were sort of various breakthroughs that happened, and you know, for example, I ended up spending 2 years trying to get through to Pino Palladino,
right?
And every angle I tried, I wouldn't get any response at all. And it wasn't until I had eventually managed to locate a guy called Jeremy Stacey, drummer, astonishing, really, really astonishing player, and he came involved in, again, one of the early tracks. He played on There Is a Dream, which is one of the tracks that are already released.
Yeah.
And when I met him and I just said, well, listen, you know, I'd love to try and get hold of so-and-so, et cetera. Listen, I've been trying to get hold of Pino for 2 years. And he said, oh, don't worry. So he kind of put the phone and called and said, hi, Pino, Jeremy here. Listen, I'm with Simon Wood Harris. He'd love you to come and play on this thing. And he said, and you know, Pino said, well, if you're playing on it, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, right.
You exactly. know, and yes. It was just like, I spent 2 fucking years trying to get Pino.
Yeah.
And that call from Jeremy opened up a whole other door. And then I could go and say to people, I've got Pino. Would you like to come and play?
Right. Yeah.
And it was like, oh, yes. And that's how it then kind of.
It's like bringing actors in on a film, isn't it? If you can get Brad Pitt, then you can probably get George Clooney, you know. But
exactly. But you had to sort of go through it again. This is a learning curve for me. It was kind of, you know, whatever else, and it was, you know, and so from that point forward, once I'd identified which track I wanted to record, then it would take, you know, months, if not a couple of years. To once I'd sort of whittled down the 5 or 6 musicians that I wanted to try and feature on it, try and whittle it down to trying to get them all on the same continent at the same time, let alone, you know, whatever else, because they were coming from all over the place. And then there would be obviously the occasional one which I couldn't get for love nor money. So it's like, you know, it wasn't a question of, right, well, who's the next choice? Mm. It was a question of, right, who else could fulfill this? This thing that we're looking for, you know, for their part.
Right.
And, you know, that ended up, you know, meaning that, you know, the search would go really far and wide. And then once you'd found them and they said that they were interested, it was then again trying to coordinate.
Yeah.
Because pretty much all of the sessions, apart from the stuff that we did for Dance the Rain, which ended up being recorded on 4 different continents over a period of like 2 years and God knows what else, everything else was pretty much done in the room at the same time.
Yeah.
So making that happen would take, you know, for each track, sometimes it would take 2 years to get the time and the place.
Right. Right.
You know, but like I could coordinate and get everybody, you know, in the room, you know, for that particular session.
Now, one of the challenges I've had in my career, I feel like we probably have a lot of similar tastes in music based on a lot of the stuff you've said. And one of the things that I've, you know, faced over the years in studios is that I've come in with this idea of what I'm trying to do, which is actually a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of this and a bit of that. And yet everyone involved is defaulting to this is going to be a standard rock approach or this is going to be a standard funk approach or whatever. And that comes down to you know, which mics they use and how they mic things up and how they EQ things and the sort of stuff they're looking at capturing and how they're going to mix it and everything. And it's always like they're trying to, it's easier for the people involved to just decide that you are, you know, quintessential rock band or quintessential jazz group or something. And what I started thinking about over the years was that when you look at the great innovators like David Bowie and Prince and, you know, the rest of them, it's not only their art that is impressive to me now, it's realizing that they had to fight every step of the way to do something that hadn't been done before. You know, all of the people involved.
Exactly, and a lot of the time, I mean, you know, they were already very well established.
Yes.
And they still had that fight.
Yes.
You know, that challenge about how to carry on evolving and how to make that happen. Because, you know, by then, everybody had their own expectations or their own impression of what the next Bowie thing should sound like.
Right.
Or God knows what else. He'd come out and surprise everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been very well aware of the challenges that those established, you know, performers would face in trying to break that through.
Let alone the rest of us.
Yeah, well, exactly. And again, you know, fairly, you know, then I encountered, you know, effectively someone who didn't have a, you know, a music career background, then sitting down with some of these people trying to, you know, put that across and for them to take it on board was again, the challenge. I mean, it was a very, very tough challenge.
Yeah.
You know, again, I was sitting down with these amazing people and, you know, I had no obvious track record in terms of that they could refer to. And again, I had to kept on saying to them, listen, I'm coming to you because of what you can bring, which I can't imagine, and what you can bring based on, you know, like, you know, what, for example, when we managed to get hold of Omar Hakim,
fantastic.
Is that sort of you know, the thing with that was for me, it was about, you know, having him, you know, he played on two tracks and having him was to me much more about the fact that I had the guy in the room who, you know, at one time played with Miles Davis and the next time had played with Daft Punk.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, you can't recreate that. You have to have the real thing come into the room, bring all of that awareness, that just musical awareness of how to be in the right place, and let them do their thing.
Yeah.
And that was and again, a lot of these guys, funny enough, you know, again, when Dominic Miller came in and I kind of, one of the first things I said to him, well, listen, I hear this kind of thing going on. I said, you know, listen, I want this kind of rhythm thing going out the whole way through, which is like a question and answer thing, but it's like a rhythm, you know, put up on. And he actually even said, you know what, I'm not even sure, even after working all this time with Sting, that I've been given almost that much freedom.
Right.
To self-express, because, you know, so, you know, Sting had always had very, very distinctive ideas what he wanted, and he just needed the players who could deliver.
Yeah,
you know, that thing, and so, yeah, it, you know, that was,
and that's also coming from a situation where, for, you know, for people like Dominic who work for artists like Sting, Dominic is probably one of the more creative and free positions in relationship with the main artist than most musicians get to be, because Sting is somebody who really lets their musicians shine and brings the best.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, there's so many other really famous artists who are like, nope, note for note, you got to play it like this. And Sting has obviously let Dominic, you know, kind of bring his thing into it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Even still, there are, I mean, he's still got to be Sting. He's still got to put out his own album. And but what I was also going to say a second ago about working with these musicians who have worked with giant names and have been very successful is that they also, I believe, one of the things that makes them successful is that they are nice people and that they are grounded people and that they're not going to come into a situation with someone who's unknown and treat them like garbage because they've got too much respect for the job.
Well, I think a lot of it was also down to the fact that a lot of them were yeah, you know, they tended to know the reputation of a lot of the other musicians yeah. that were in the room, even if they hadn't played with them before. You know, I had, you know, so I'd have Omar playing with Robbie McIntosh, you know, on guitars and obviously all the stuff that he had done. And then, you know, really kind of, you know, so there was a lot of awareness and sort of respect between them, whether they'd worked with each other or not.
Yeah.
So there was they knew they were in a room of equal peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Musically. So they knew what these other people could achieve given that sort of thing. So you put four or five of them in a room and like it's like holy crap, you know, just kind of. You know, a lot of my production style in these things was, you know, I'd sit down with them. I'd rarely let anybody hear anything before until they turned up at the session. I'd sit down, I'd sit at the piano, you know, play the song three or four times, howl away and whatever else. And then my production technique was to leave for 3 or 4 hours and let them kind of do their thing.
Right.
Just, you know, start to see what, you know, what happened. And then I'd sort of come back and just say, well, most of the time I'd come back and think, oh my God, that's I had yeah. no concept of it being able to go there. Right, now let's kind of just rein this in and can we go off more, you know, I want more of this kind of, you know,
yeah.
stuff and whatever else. So that was, and again, yeah, as you just said, they were incredibly kind of, they allowed me, you know, this completely inexperienced, individual to, you know, they allowed me to sort of throw my bit in
yeah.
and respect that and then take it even to a further level. So that was an amazing part.
You don't get to where they've gotten to by being a prick. You know, that's just, yeah. it doesn't work like that. And also, I think it's easy to forget that these musicians are making a living and we know them because they're on this album or that album or whatever, but often those albums are years apart. And in the meantime, day to day, they're working with loads of people like yourself. You know, it's actually part of their job is to turn up to a studio with an artist who may not know who it is, but cool, let's get on with it, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Oh, listen, you know, and you know, I mean, it wasn't always the perfect storm and there were a good number of pricks in there. who ended up, you know, I ended up not leaving on the stuff,
right.
you know, or whatever yeah. else. Because, you know, but yes, overall it was, you know, the experience of those days and those things were you know, I'd come away kind of exhausted
yeah.
just from the sheer amount of surprise and like, oh my God, I had no idea it could be there. It could yeah. be, we could have got to that point. And again, I think part of it, I think they appreciated the fact that I kind of have provided that framework for them to be able to express themselves. And then actually, I think, you know, on many occasions, you know, a lot of them were kind of used that freedom to also take it to a level that they hadn't expected.
Yeah.
You know, they came away having achieved something which I think surprised even them.
Yes. That's the end of part one of my conversation with Simon Wood Harris. His project is called Unidentified Flying Project. Punch them into Facebook and YouTube and the internet, you will find him. Great stuff, really amazing musicians, great songs. It's really fantastic. And while you're at it, please remember to like and share and click and comment and all that stuff. We're an independent little podcast, and All of your support is our oxygen. It's what keeps us going. All right, our artist feature for today. This is a song from Peyton Moret. I think it's Moret or Moret, M-O-R-E-T-E. Peyton is a singer-songwriter based in Wellington, and this is a song called Stay.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share and subscribe and give us a review on iTunes.